Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 7, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we get a litigation update on the University of Texas and affirmative action. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome our expert, Edward Bloom. He's a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also president of Students for Fair Admissions, and importantly, he's a litigant not only in the University of Texas case, but also in the Harvard and North Carolina affirmative action cases, so he might be somewhat limited in what he can say. We're going to begin with opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes. As always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please have those in mind. With that, Mr. Edward Bloom, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I'd like to welcome all Federalist Society members to this call, and I appreciate Dean highlighting the fact that I am a litigant in all three of these cases and have been reminded by counsel to be very circumspect in my remarks and my answers to your questions. Let me begin by just telling everyone a little bit about Students for Fair Admissions and then go into our Texas lawsuit. This is an organization now made up of approaching 22,000 individuals. We formed this organization in 2014, shortly after the U.S. Supreme Court rendered its opinion in Abigail Fisher versus the University of Texas, Part 1. It was our belief, and I think the belief of many of my friends at the Federalist Society and throughout the public policy world, that racial preferences needed an organization in which people could join. Membership organizations are powerful, whether it's the NAACP or the Friends of Wildlife, for people to commit their names and their modest membership fees really spoke volumes to us as the potential for not only litigation, but also advocacy. So we formed this organization in 2014, and in November of 2014, the organization itself, made up of individuals who were denied admission to Harvard University and to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the organization itself filed suit in federal court against those two universities. Those two cases are ongoing. We have not even completed discovery in them. And during Q&A, I'm sure many of you are curious about what's going on with those cases, especially in light of the developments at the Department of Justice a week ago. Let me talk now about the University of Texas case and clarify that this is a brand new lawsuit filed with, obviously, Students for Fair Admissions, a brand new plaintiff organization in a brand new legal venue. We are not in federal court the way we were, obviously, in Fisher 1 and Fisher 2. But we have sued the University of Texas in state court. And for those who would like to study sort of the differences between our actions in federal court with Fisher and our theory and actions, arguments, in now Students for Fair Admissions versus University of Texas in state court, you can find our complaint at our website, studentsforfairadmissions.org. You can read the full complaint there and our press release. We make three unique claims that to bolster our theory that the University of Texas is forbidden from using race and ethnicity in their admissions process. Before I go into those three claims, or actually just focus on what we think is one of the most powerful of the three, I'd like to just remind everyone how unique the University of Texas's admissions policy is compared to the rest of the country. Many of you will recall from Fisher versus the University of Texas that for about 7 or 8 years, the University of Texas, along with every other school in the state, was forbidden from considering a student's race or ethnicity. That was the result of some earlier litigation challenging race and ethnicity in the admissions process at the University of Texas School of Law. That case was styled Hopwood versus the University of Texas, and the Hopwood plaintiffs were successful in ending the use of race and ethnicity, not only at the law school, but at the undergraduate level at UT as well. In response to that, the Texas legislature passed what is now commonly called the Top 10% Plan. That was designed really to address the grave concerns that many people had that racial diversity at the law school and racial, well, not at the law school, but at the undergraduate school would be decimated because of the Hopwood ruling. President George W. Bush, then Governor George W. Bush, signed that law in 1997, and I believe 1998 was the first year that the Top 10% Plan went into effect. Shortly, I guess maybe a year or two tops after that law went into effect, which many of you will recall, permits any student who has graduated in the top 10% of their high school class, regardless of their SAT scores, regardless of their outside activities, to attend any university in the state. The effect of that, by 1998 or 1999, was that the amount of diversity, the number of African Americans and Hispanics in attendance at the University of Texas because of the Top 10% Plan, surpassed the number of minorities when race-based affirmative action was in effect. So our argument in Fisher, and one of our arguments in the new Students for Fair Admissions lawsuit, is that that top 10% plan, which is now a top 7% plan, forbid the university from considering a student's race or ethnicity. As you know, we were disappointed in the outcome of Fisher II. However, we believe that the Texas Constitution has three provisions that allow us to prevail. And I think the most important provision, and the one that I'll concentrate on now and then turn this forum over to Q&A, is a provision that was passed by the voters in the state of Texas in 1972. For lack of a better name, we call it the Texas Equal Rights Amendment. This amendment was put before the voters in 1972, 80% of whom voted to approve it, only 20% voted to not approve it. And I'm going to read you the provision that was passed by the voters and is now part of the amended Texas Constitution. And it reads as follows, quote, "Equality under the law shall not be denied or abridged because of sex, race, color, creed, or national origin." Now, if that sounds familiar to many of you who live in the state of California, who live in the state of Washington, or live in the state of Michigan, or a handful of other states, that language is almost verbatim the language of Prop 209, the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, the Washington State Civil Rights Initiative, and others that my friend and colleague Ward Connerly tirelessly worked to enact. That language, we believe, is what is in the Texas Constitution and forbids the University of Texas from using race-based affirmative action in its admissions policy. With that, I know that many of you are interested not only in the Texas lawsuit, but the recent developments out of the Department of Justice. So, Dean, I will take Q&A.
Thank you so much. We're speaking with Ed Bloom about several different cases, as it turns out. We're going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. A reminder that Ed Bloom is a litigant in these cases, so he might have to decline to answer some pointed questions you might have, but we'll take all questions and we can sort that out as we go through. Let me just start very quickly. You mentioned a website, a URL address. I want to have it repeated for people who might want to jot it down and give them a chance to get their pens and pencils. Could you repeat that, the website you mentioned? Ed?
I surely can. It's all one word, studentsforfairadmissions.org. And that website will provide you immediately with the Texas complaint. And under legal updates, you will find also our complaint in Harvard and our complaint in UNC.
Very good. Again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We begin with three questions today. Let's turn to our first caller.
Hi, Ed. This is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. Thanks so much for updating us today. I've admired your work for a long time on this this issue, even when others, have given up after some bad court decisions. Couple of questions for you. One, what do you think is going to happen at DOJ and at OCR? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that at this point they really are just investigating that one complaint that Obama ignored. But, of course, this may encourage other people to file complaints. So do you see this as being a useful angle, or do you really think it'll take private litigation to make a difference? And then question number two is, if you win in the Texas Supreme Court, are you concerned that UT will do what the losers of Proposition 2 in Michigan did, which is run to federal court and argue that precluding affirmative action as a remedy is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause? In other words, basically saying finding a positive right to affirmative action in effect that, of course, would trump any Texas law.
Kurt, thanks for both questions. I think the second one is the easiest, so I will I'll speculate on that. I think the door has been shut on the outcome that you just described. The Supreme Court, I think with the inclusion of Justice Breyer in the Schutte case, and I can't recall exactly what year that was. It may have been 2013 or 2014. That seems to me to be settled law. As you know, I'm not an attorney, and I turn to people like Kurt Levy and Will Consovoy and friends throughout the FedSoc world for additional guidance. But I am not that concerned, considering that Schutte seems to be good law in that area. Going back to your question on OCR and DOJ, I'll begin by telling you and the rest of our FedSoc community that I greatly encourage DOJ to get involved in this issue. Get involved not only in looking at the complaints that the Asian American Coalition filed back in 2015 and 16, but new complaints that I know were filed with OCR just this past week. I received at least four or five emails and phone calls from individuals who had been denied admission to a variety of highly competitive schools throughout the country, wanting some insight as to how one goes about filing a complaint to OCR, and I sent them to various websites and had fruitful discussions with them. So I am hopeful that not only DOJ and DOE take up this issue, but we have ongoing litigation with Harvard and UNC right now, and we would welcome the Department of Justice's activities and intervention in those two cases as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just two questions pending with like lots of time left. Let's take another call.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for joining us. This is Ted Prank. I was curious about the choice to go after University of North Carolina because if that's litigated in federal court, that goes up to the Fourth Circuit, which would seem to be an unfavorable jurisdiction for this sort of argument. And I'm wondering to what extent searching for the right forum has come into play in these decisions.
Ted, that's a good question. It takes me into some weeds that perhaps I shouldn't be in, but I'm going to see if I can flesh out an answer to your general inquiry. I have always learned that the most important first threshold in filing litigation has been do no harm. So I don't want to be involved in lawsuits in which what is mostly bad law becomes worse law. We believed when we filed UNC, and we still believe it today, that our claim there, which is that the University of North Carolina, in an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in 2013 in Fisher versus the University of Texas, round one, an amicus brief, by the way, in which UNC wrote separately, they did not join other flagship universities, told the court that they could actually achieve greater racial diversity using a race-neutral alternative along the lines of what the University of Texas does than they would continuing to use racial classifications and preferences. That, to us, painted a bullseye on the University of North Carolina. Their response was, and they told the court this in 2013, that if we did that, while we would have greater campus racial diversity, the average SAT scores of our incoming freshmen would drop, a dozen plus points, and that would just be a bridge too far for us and our high academic reputation throughout the country. When students contact you and tell you about their academic background, their grades and activities and SAT scores, and you see the kind of injustice that you see at UNC and Harvard and other schools, it's hard to say no. And this was a lawsuit that you kind of have to say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and I'm glad we did it. Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. Before we take the next question from the audience, let me just ask a very quick question, if I could. You mentioned the Texas Constitution and the voter, imposed or voted on Texas Equal Rights Amendment in 1972. Did that come as a result of pushback against affirmative action, as did Prop 209? Or was it before that? Or does that even matter in terms of a court looking at the Texas Equal Rights Amendment?
It doesn't matter, Dean, and it is unclear to me if this particular constitutional provision was the result of racial discrimination, was the result of discrimination by sex or national origin. It sort of speaks for itself. As I recall, throughout the early 1970s, there was an effort nationally to introduce an equal rights amendment that the states never embraced, a constitutional amendment to our federal constitution. This may have been part of that overall effort. I know a number of states passed provisions very similar to this, but the bottom line is that it doesn't really matter what the predicate was. This, in our opinion, forbids UT from judging people by race, ethnicity, creed, color, or national origin or sex.
Very good. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our next caller.
Hello, Ed. It's Bill Helfand in Houston. Like the other callers, I would certainly commend you for your persistence as well as your erudition in this area of law. I'm intrigued by the state court filing, but if you don't mind me bringing it a little bit closer to my home, in light of the results that you mentioned relating to the University of Texas from the Top 10 program, has your organization considered lobbying the Texas legislature to make changes?
Bill, it's good to hear from you. Thanks for the call. We have been, I think I speak for Students for Fair Admissions and other advocacy groups. We have received over the years a number of inquiries from Texas legislators who were interested in introducing a Prop 209 type statute. And in fact, as I recall, I think in 1995 or 1996, one Texas legislator actually introduced 209 language. Sadly, he never had a co-sponsor of that statute, and sadly, that statute never really made it out of committee. The statewide leadership at the time was all Republican, and no one in our state, I was a Texan at that time, no one in an elected position endorsed it. I have been in contact, some Texas legislators have contacted me and expressed interest in doing this. I've encouraged them to do it. But Bill, it is a mystery to me why one of the most conservative states in the union, one of the most conservative legislative bodies in the union, has not taken this initiative on themselves. It is our hope that Attorney General Paxton, who, God love him, when asked after the Supreme Court ruled last summer in Fisher, was asked, "Are you pleased that the university prevailed in this lawsuit?" And Attorney General Paxton said no. He was disappointed in the outcome of Fisher. I think that was a remarkably candid and courageous statement. I think it reflected not only General Paxton's opinion, but according to a 2016 Gallup poll, 7 out of 10 Americans agreed with General Paxton that race and ethnicity should not be an element in university admissions. So it's my hope that perhaps before this lawsuit is settled, that the legislature on behalf of the people of Texas will change the law. It is also my hope that the Attorney General of the state of Texas can add some clarity to what he thinks the Texas Constitution prohibits and what it allows. Good to hear from you, Bill. I haven't talked to you in a while. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our phones are now wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I'll ask a follow-up question if I could, and that is with regard to the state AG there, Ken Paxton. You mentioned his possibly getting involved. I don't know if you can say more about that. Would that be through direct intervention or through an amicus brief or some other means, or are there a number of options available to him here?
Dean, as I understand it, there are a number of different options. The Attorney General, General Paxton, recently wrote an amicus brief in another case that was filed in federal court in Texas challenging how directors of the State Bar of Texas were nominated and then appointed to the Texas Bar Board of Directors. I provided counsel to an attorney in Texas who challenged the hard numeric quota that the Texas Bar was using in appointing people to the Board of Directors. General Paxton, a couple of weeks after that suit was filed, wrote an amicus brief to the Federal District Court, in which he provided his support to the plaintiff challenging the constitutionality of that minority quota. So I know that General Paxton can write an amicus brief. I'm fairly confident that that office can intervene. There may be other things that a state AG can do in the course of state litigation. I would encourage the AG's office to participate with us in this, what we believe is a blatant violation of the Texas Constitution.
Well, this gives me the opportunity to make a blatant plug for the Federal Society of National Lawyers Convention, in which the State Attorney General Ken Paxton has agreed to participate. He'll be one of our panelists at this upcoming National Lawyers Convention of the Federal Society, November 16th through 18th. Right now, of course, we're talking to Ed Bloom. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. We'll threaten to dismiss the call or adjourn the call early if we need to. Push the star button and then the pound button on your phone if you have a question. We do have a question here, so let's take another call.
David Emerson at the Berkeley Federalist Society. And you know, the question I have, Berkeley's been, of course, part of this discussion for a number of years. The question I have is that, you know, regardless of whether the court outcome might be, it seems like there's plenty of opportunity to circumvent, for example, in California, Prop 209 by various means, meaning holistic evaluation of candidates. And I guess my question for the speaker is, what thoughts do you have about or prohibiting or at least making more difficult some of these attempts to evade the effects of a Prop 209 type of law?
Thank you, Mr. Emerson. That's a great question, and I do have an answer for you. The conservative and libertarian legal movement and advocacy organizations are in desperate need of a new organization designed to catch the what we believe are cheaters in states that have banned preferences like this. There needs to be a group that gathers data, analyzes that data, and holds each university's feet to the fire. I am hopeful that answer will spark some interest throughout our FedSoc community to look into forming an organization like that. I know there are individuals and foundations that would be interested in supporting that kind of work, and there are prominent lawyers and social scientists like Professor Rick Sander at UCLA and others who would, I know, be very interested in participating. So I hope that that gets to the heart of your question. Thank you for it, Mr. Emerson.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button, then the pound button. While we're waiting to see if anybody rings in with a final question, let me ask you just to go over briefly again, if you could, the road forward in this case in particular. What's next now that the case has been filed? What does it look like unfolding?
Yes. Well, General Paxton has allowed the University of Texas to seek outside counsel, which they have done. I will make available UT's response on our website. Thanks for reminding me that, Dean. That would have been a helpful thing. So that our community can look at UT's response. It is striking when you look at UT's response that they don't address any of the Texas statutory or constitutional provisions that we highlight in our complaint. Instead, they have called this lawsuit a retread of Fisher versus the University of Texas, and have pointedly informed the court that this is just the activity of three individuals: Edward Bloom, Abigail Fisher, and Richard Fisher, who are board members of Students for Fair Admissions, to relitigate Fisher in state court. That is patently inaccurate, and I think our next step is we will probably have some kind of a status conference with the state district judge in Travis County to determine the scope of how this case unfolds, whether it's through discovery or whether it's just going to be a kind of a legal argument. We ought to have more information about that, Dean, in, I would say, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks.
Very good. We do have a couple more questions now, so let's carry on with our audience.
Ed, Bill again, could you just share with us what outside counsel the state has retained for that purpose?
Yes, they've gone to an Austin firm called Graves Daugherty. Graves, G-R-A-V-E-S, Daugherty, typical Daugherty spelling. They are, I believe, a highly respected firm. They, from just looking at their website, I think they have probably 75-plus lawyers. They are well-known throughout the Austin legal community. They have highly respected litigators, and I am sure they're going to put up a very good fight.
Thanks for sharing that.
We do have one more caller on the line. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's head in a new direction here.
Hi, Ed. Ted Frank again. And someday offline, we should talk about what you're looking for in terms of increased organizational activity. But I had a question on the idea that, well, this is just a rehash of Fisher, because one of the, I thought, interesting language in Fisher was, well, we don't have enough data about what the program is actually doing and the effect that it's having. And that suggested to me that a rehash could come to the opposite result if data demonstrated the sort of prejudice that would not be acceptable under the Constitution, even under Fisher II.
That's a very insightful comment. I am not sure the contours going forward. We have a university like UT where a lot of admissions data is public, unlike the difficulty that we had to go through with Harvard to get their admissions data. A lot of this is well known and well documented. There are other contours that a long discovery process could possibly take. There was an investigation by the Kroll group into kind of cronyism among certain administrators and the admissions process, going back at least through the Abigail Fisher years, 2008 through 2016. So there are a number of interesting things that could happen with discovery, and it's we'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
Let me make a final call for questions. Now's the time. Our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
I could throw in another question if I still have the floor.
You still have the floor. Ted Frank.
Have there been law students seeking to challenge what's happening at law schools? The suits against the law schools haven't happened yet. Though there's a theory of mismatch that would seem to be very supportive of it, and data that would support that if you could get discovery of what bar exam results are doing. Is it just that prospective law students have been reluctant to come to you, or is it a lack of resources? Is it something else?
Ted, it's all of that, I'll back up by saying that we do, through our studentsforfairadmissions.org website, get lots of inquiries from applicants rejected from undergraduate programs, the vast majority undergraduate programs, but many from law schools, many from medical schools, and I agree with you. The power of the mismatch in those arenas where there is a post training national or statewide test would be I think a very interesting area of litigation. Resources, of course, are a problem, I guess if I could be so candid as to say to this group that there are, while I would like to pursue professional schools, I think that looking at the state constitutions of a handful of other states and looking at the makeup of a handful of other state Supreme Courts, that is probably the area that our limited resources will direct us in the future. For anyone who's kind of curious about this, I would like them to review the Wisconsin state constitution and the admissions practices at the University of Wisconsin. That to me seems like that is an area that, like the Texas Constitution, would provide us a very good avenue to continue chipping away at these.
We do have one more question at this point. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Good afternoon. This is Ned Jacobs. Thank you for this very interesting presentation. Is there any likelihood in your judgment that the United States Supreme Court may find that requirements of state constitutions, for instance, that require non-recognition of racial factors in the admissions to various kinds of schools are themselves racist and therefore a violation of equal protection because they are based upon a history of discrimination that puts people of racial minorities behind the eight ball?
Mr. Jacobs, that was a long question. I'll be candid. I think I addressed that earlier in the call when I referenced Kurt Levy's question about the challenge to the amended Michigan State Constitution a handful of years ago. In that Supreme Court case, Schutte, or I think it was styled by any means necessary, by any means necessary, BAMN versus Schutte, litigants challenged the voter-approved referendum outlawing the use of racial considerations at the University of Michigan. That case, this is all from memory, was won by the state of Michigan in a 6-3 opinion that drew Justice Breyer on the side of the majority. The holding there was that it is not a violation of the Constitution for a state to outlaw, prohibit racial considerations in university admissions or contracting, employment. So I think that was your question, and that was the answer that I gave to Mr. Levy. Thank you.
Well, Ed Bloom, we are out of questions. We still have a few minutes left if you want to express a final thought or say anything by way of wrapping up.
Well, Dean, just let me thank you for organizing this. This is the first time I have spoken to a Dolly Madison Federalist Society podcast. I enjoyed it. I am very hopeful that we can do this again in another 6 months or a year as all three of these cases twist and turn the courts. Thank you, Dean.
Well, thank you. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Ed Bloom, for joining us today. And we do look forward to having you back again as these cases, all three of them, proceed. I want to thank the audience as well. A quick reminder to the audience, check your emails, check the website for upcoming Teleform conference calls. The next scheduled call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the same number. We'll be talking about ransomware. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.